guardi più.
Oh.
Sankirtan. Japa is a very... How many of you have done japa before? And you've been studying Bhagavad Gita, so you know what Krishna says about japa. So, of all sacrifices, I am japa. It can be done three ways. In the mind, softly uttered, or loudly. Depends how ecstatic you are and how that ecstasy manifests. So, japa is a very nice way to begin your day. And kirtan, satatam kirtayanto mam, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Always chanting. So, kirtan in this day and age is a particularly easy, melodic, rhythmic way to meditate on the Maha Mantra in particular. So we'll do a little kirtan.
Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna.
Does anyone know the four secrets to be able to chant incessantly? There's four secrets. First is humility. Second is tolerance. Third is no desire for recognition, for prestige. And then the fourth secret is give respect to all living entities. And in such a state of mind, one can chant incessantly. So Bhagavad Gita. I'm very new to your class. And I'm very old friends with Joshua. We go back at least to 1975. We lived in and around the same ashram for several years before we went in our directions. So I'm very, very happy and honored that he has invited me to be here with you all. I know he says that this has been like an ongoing class for like the last 5 or 6 years, and I'm many of you have, are seriously meditating on studying Bhagavad Gita. So I'm very honored and to be here. And Joshua told me that the last verse that he spoke on, or you all meditated upon, was the 16th verse of the 4th chapter. So we're on 17, verse 17 of the 4th chapter, which is on page 205. Page 205. So this is an often referred to chapter, transcendental knowledge, is indicated here, Divya Gyan. In many places in Gita and many different places in Vedas, there's Gyan and there's Divya Gyan. Divya Gyan, Divya means transcendental, and Gyan means knowledge. So this is knowledge not of a mundane nature, but of a totally transcendental spiritual nature. In terms of my practice, I've been practicing Bhakti Yoga for 40 years, and in Bhakti, there are five key elements to Bhakti. One is Sangha. Sangha means association, to be in association. And one of the key components of association, I had a class, gave a class prior to here, coming here at the Bhakti Center on honesty, the cultivation of honesty within the heart in order to further your spiritual practice. But in terms of the transcendental knowledge, we have to, in my the practice of yoga that I do, Bhakti, Sangha is one of the most important elements. Because Sangha, in the proper Sangha, Sangha is a very important element, and it is an important responsibility. Because in the proper association, like-minded people, and one really key component of Sangha is to be in association with someone who's very advanced in terms of transcendental knowledge. And by that association comes Shraddha. Shraddha means two things. It can mean faith, and it also means inspiration. So by being in proper association, if we cultivate proper association, it gives us inspiration. And from inspiration is the springboard. You know, because sometimes when we perform our practices, our spiritual practices, our yoga, our discipline, our system, however you may want to categorize it, and if you do it alone, in the privacy of your home, there's so many things that can distract us. Isn't it true? We have to contend with laziness. We have to contend with apathy. And we have to contend with the innumerable things that occur in our life which distract us and actually draw our attention away from our practice. And this is common. So the reason why Sangha is so important is that in association, my teacher, Srila Prabhupada, gave the analogy of one stick by itself, one twig by itself, can be broken very easily. But if you have a bunch of sticks bound together, it's very difficult to break. So in Sangha, in association, even though you or I, you know, we may be easily distracted, or we may be lazy by nature or apathetic, in association with the proper teacher and the proper peers comes a lot of inspiration and a lot of support and nourishment. So Sangha is very important. Second thing is mantra. And that's why we started with three aspects of mantra. Chanted the Om. We chanted in silent meditation, japa. Or if you're more comfortable with uttering japa, that's also acceptable. And so japa is there, chanting of Om, which is like a seed bija mantra, the mantra that sets the tone. And then third is kirtan, my teacher would always recommend, he would say, in your spiritual practice, develop a no-gap philosophy. And what does a no-gap philosophy mean? By japa, I chant japa 2 hours every day. By kirtan, I chant kirtan every day. By sangha, I try to keep sangha every day, association every day. And this way, we have a full stream of contact or connection, because after all, yoga means connection. We have a full stream of connection at all. So we adjust and we do our day in that particular way. Ahuitiki and pratihata. That means uninterrupted and without personal motivation, you know, for self-aggrandizement. So in this way, sangha is important, mantra is important. Then also, third aspect would be swadhyaya. Swadhyaya means study. In each aspect of mantra, sangha, swadhyaya, study, it puts us in connection with the Supreme. Each aspect of that. So study, coming in, using the intelligence, using the mind, the citta is comprised of three things. Citta is comprised of mind, which takes in all the sensory impulses, and then memorizes, categorizes, and accepts and rejects. Another aspect of citta, or the overmind, overall consciousness, is intelligence. And intelligences are discriminatory and our judgment power. And then there's ego, ahamkar, and that's identity. Each one of these can be utilized. Mind, intelligence, ego can be utilized to reconnect us with the Absolute. So, sangha does that. Swadhyaya uses your intelligence. You can think, meditate upon the instructions coming from Krishna. And then there's tirtha, or holy place. And a holy place does not just mean going to India or going to a place like that. Vrindavan or Rishikesh, Pushkar, or any of that. It does not just mean that. Those are holy places that are there for our nourishment. But holy place means in your home. You establish within your home a holy place, a sacred place, a sacred space. And what does that do? It develops the sacred space within your heart. So you can carry that sacred space wherever you go. And finally, there's ritual. But not ritual, mindless ritual. Ritual that just is perfunctory. We want to do ritual that connects us to the Supreme. Therefore, it becomes spiritual. It's not just ritual. It becomes spiritual. And all of these things together, combinedly, help at every aspect, every moment of our day, to connect us. We can do that. So now we are doing swadhyaya. We're doing study. And the importance of swadhyaya, or study, is we hear from an authority, Krishna, and then we reflect. In Vedic culture, there's four aspects of knowledge. One is to hear. Right? When you go to the university, you sit and you listen to the professor, right? And you take notes. And then he asks for questions. And you raise your hand, or you don't raise your hand, or you fall asleep. One or the other. Right? So, you hear. How else are you going to get knowledge? Even reading is hearing. It's hearing through the mind. And then, reflection. Once you heard, then you reflect upon it. What does that actually mean? Krishna's talking about karma. Action. What does that mean? What is action? So then you reflect upon it. And then once you've heard and reflected, then you assimilate it into your life. You take that teaching and you embody it. You incorporate it into your life. And the last aspect of the Vedic paradigm for knowledge, for acquiring knowledge, is sharing. Because there's nothing which makes this knowledge sweeter and more profound than to share it with others. After you've heard it, you've reflected upon it, you're attempting to assimilate it, and then you share it with others and hear how they've heard it and how they've reflected upon it and how they are assimilating it into their lives. And that last aspect of sharing really kind of sets the process in motion again. It's kind of a cyclical process. that once you share with others and you become, you feel the enlivenment that comes from that, that sparks the desire to hear again, to reflect some more, to attempt to continue the assimilation process, and to share. And then this is a cyclical process it goes. So this kind of no gap, where eventually your mind, regardless of where it is, work or play, it still has connection or contact with the Supreme. In other words, it sees everything in relationship with the Supreme. So we're doing Swadhyaya study. And does Joshua go over the Sanskrit or no?
He does call and response, and then depending on who's here, some people try and do it. Some people don't have one here that don't necessarily read English. I'm dyslexic. But so we do it. Yeah, we do it. You do the line, and then we repeat it, and then the next line we repeat it.
Okay, good. With Sanskrit, this has been made very easy for us. It's called Roman transliteration. And it is extremely bisyllable. There are some little quirks, but mostly it's bisyllable. For instance, in text 17, you see the first word is three different syllables. Kar-ma-no. So it's kar-ma-no. And whenever you see a Y, it's usually like he. That's he. Like H-Y is like he. Like almost like an E. So kar-ma-no, he. Now, a little trick is when Y and A are together, it's kind of rolled into each other. So it's kar-ma-no, yapi. Yapi. Kar-ma-no, yapi. And then again, bod, hav, yam. Actually, when the M has a dot over it, it's kind of like an NG. Bod of yam. So I'll do the first line. Go slowly, listen to me. Karma no yapi bodhavyam. You repeat. Karma no yapi bodhavyam. Very good. Second line, which is a repeat of the last word. Bodhavyam cha, C usually is CH. Bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. Repeat. Bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. When you see an H at the end and a vowel before it, and it's at either, it's on an even line, which means either the second or fourth line, it's aha. It's not just ah, it's aha. So bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. Like that. Okay? Repeat again, second line. Bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. Third line. When you see an S with a slash over it, it's SH. So this would be akarmanash cha bodhavyam. Repeat. Akarmanash cha bodhavyam. Gahana karmano gatihi. Gahana karmano gatihi. Do it one more time. Karmano yapi bodhavyam.
Karmano yapi bodhavyam.
Bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. Bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. Akarmanash cha bodhavyam. Akarmanash cha bodhavyam. Gahana karmano gatihi. Gahana karmano gatihi. Okay, so then we have the breakdown. So this way you can get an understanding of word by word replay here. So karmana means of work. He, certainly. Api, also. Bodhavyam should be understood. Bodhavyam should be understood. Cha, also. Thikarmana, of forbidden works. Akarmana, of inaction. Cha, also. Bodhavim, should be understood. Gahana, very difficult. Karmana, of work. Gati, entrance. So the verse put together reads as follows. The intricacies of action are very hard to understand. Therefore, one should know properly what action is, what forbidden action is, and what inaction is. Now, if you can repeat the line together, everybody. The intricacies of action are very hard to understand. Therefore, one should know properly what action is, what forbidden action is, and what inaction is. Sound confusing? Do you read purport also or no? Okay. So this is a very significant word. You've all heard the word karma before. And you know that karma means actions. But also karma means reaction. Action, for every action, there's a reaction. That's the full meaning of karma. It's not only that we act, but from the Gita paradigm, every action that you perform has a reaction. So from the Vedic culture paradigm, dharma means to act properly. Karma, dharma. Dharma means proper action. And there's two types of dharma. There's dharma means action that you perform on a daily basis. Asat dharma and sat dharma or sanatana dharma, which means that which you perform on an eternal level. Forever, in eternity, which means it is the action of the soul. We're in this body, currently we're embodied. Female body, male body, whatever our ethnicity is, whatever we have in terms of things that we are suffering, things that we are enjoying, it's all a result of action that we've performed. And what we have right now is exactly where we're supposed to be. Exactly who we're supposed to be. Because of what? Because of the action that we perform and the subsequent reaction. This is the Gita. This is what Gita is telling us. That we are all responsible for everything that we do and say. And in previous ages, even what you think. But in this age, we're given special dispensation. That you won't be held accountable. Could you imagine being held accountable for everything that you think? I mean, it would be pretty bad. So we're given special dispensation in this particular age. This particular age is called Kali. Yuga means the time period. This particular span of universal time is called Kali Yuga. There are three previous ages. Satya, the age of truth. Treta, Dwarpara, and then Kali Yuga. Four, just like you divide the year into spring, summer, fall, and winter. So we're now in the winter season. It's like you're now in New York City in January. Okay? So blizzards and cold and ice and all kinds of things, disruptive things are there. Now it's 75 degrees out, kind of like at the end, next to the last day of spring. So we're in the end of spring, the beginning of summer. It's a really nice, that's Satya Yuga. But Kali Yuga is described as the age of hypocrisy, quarrel, and distraction. That at the drop of a hat, people will quarrel. Right? Someone makes, you bump into somebody on the street accidentally. Hey man, what are you doing? You know, immediately ready to jump in your face. So it's the age which people are very quarrelsome. and very hypocritical. Say one thing, do another thing. So in this particular day and age, we've been given that special dispensation that there's no reaction to what you think. But there is reaction to your words. So if you are verbally abusive to someone, you get a negative reaction. And reactions are unique in the sense that it's not immediately that you get pounded with the reaction. Reactions go into seed form. Just like use the analogy of a plant. You have the seed, you plant the seed begins to nurture, right? And then it begins to sprout roots, and then all of a sudden you see a little sprout, and then from sprout it goes to full maturation. So reactions are like that. That's why we may do something and we may not feel or experience the reaction for a long period of time. Or we may experience it, depending on the nature of the action. So action is the overall, karma is the overall. Krishna herein describes that within action, there's three divisions of action. There's karma, which is the overall, but it also has a specific meaning. If we take it as overall action-reaction, then within that framework of overall action-reaction, there's karmic action. It means action that is governed by spiritual law. For instance, in the Vedic, so many literatures in the Vedic, Manu Samhita, it's the law of mankind. And practically speaking, everything that you do gives you the dharmic way to do it. And why do dharmic action, why perform action which is considered good action? It creates an internal mindset, an internal environment which is conducive for spiritual life. Why do you think Patanjali says in the Eightfold System of Yoga, Yama Niyama? Why are those the first two things? Rules and regulations, you know, things that you practice for yourself, thinking regulations that you follow. Because without doing that, yama and niyama, or without performing actions which are dharmic, then what happens is your mindset is not conducive for spiritual practice. And you won't believe in spirituality. B, even if you do believe in spirituality, you don't have the discipline, the strength, the determination to do it. So what this does, proper action, that's why Krishna is emphasizing it here, is it creates a suitable environment. It's called sattva. Sattva means goodness. According to Bhagavad Gita, all the energy around you, the material energy, the earth, the water, the fire, air, ether, those are the five gross elements that Krishna describes in Gita. And then the four subtle elements that Krishna, three subtle elements, mind, intelligence, and ego, all of them produce an influence that's broken up into three divisions: goodness, passion, and ignorance. So if we act properly, according to the dharmic way, proper action, it creates within you the proper mindset, a conducive mindset, by which you can understand the basic principles of spirituality. And without that, in other words, the further we go into vikarma, vikarma means inappropriate action. The definition of vikarma can be inappropriate, whimsical, without any regulation. Pretty much do whatever you feel like doing, and no boundaries, right? You don't see the need for boundaries. So karma produces good reactions. Vikarma produces bad reactions, negativity. Puts you in a negative frame of mind. It makes you relate more to negativity. You feel more comfortable in anger. You feel more comfortable in greed. You feel more comfortable in lamentation. You feel more comfortable. And some people do feel that's their comfort zone. They have no qualms about outbursts, you know, or shouting at their kid or their spouse or their friend or driving road rage, you know, so many different things. There's no boundaries, you know, you just can't control yourself. All of this, Krishna's trying to give us some indication. He's letting us know that there is implication in everything that we do. And we see that as we evolve as human beings, as people, we see that there's implication. If I mistreat someone, it comes back. If I point a finger, there's three fingers pointing back at me. You know, we see that there's implications to whatever I do. That's because it's a universal principle that is incorporated. When there's creation, there's actually principles, universal principles that are also created. And the universal principle, when the soul, the spirit soul, is in the material realm, the universal principle is called the laws of karma. And the laws of karma will be good reaction or bad reaction, in making it very simple. So it doesn't get, but even with good reaction, it describes in Gita and other places, describes what are good reactions that you get. Health is a good reaction. Beauty is a good reaction. Aristocracy is a good reaction. There are different reactions. You're born into, that's why I said, where you are right now is exactly where you should be and exactly what we deserve. The family that we took birth in, where our body and the health of our body or the unhealthy state of our body, it's exactly. Because there are some people who live an unhealthy, you know, from certain perspectives, live an unhealthy lifestyle, but they never get sick. They eat anything that they want, they do whatever they want, they never get sick. And there are other people who are very, very conscious of what they eat and how much they sleep and cleanliness and so many, and they get sick. Because there is that element. It's not to say that we just say, okay, let me figure out whether I'm healthy or unhealthy, and I'll make that determination whether I'm going to have a clean lifestyle or not. No, but the point is, karmically it's there. And that's part of the positive reaction. You get health, it's a positive reaction. Negative reaction, unhealthy condition, legal problems, you just, all of a sudden you're smacked with some fine or something. And there's all kinds of different negative reactions that you get. So as long as you act within the laws of karma, if you do karma, then you'll do your action in recognition that there's a higher power. And then you'll get positive reaction. Dikarma means you don't pay attention that there's anything other than you. You're the center of the universe and you do whatever you want to do. And that's called dikarma. And you get negative reaction to that. Now the last one is called akarma. Anywhere that you see the letter A before a word, like karma, you know the word karma. Akarma means no action. So how can you not act? Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that even I must act. Everyone must act according to the nature. What does repression accomplish? Krishna says that. So what does inaction actually mean? Inaction actually means that you're performing Dibya karma. You're performing transcendental action. You're performing action that is directly in relationship to the Supreme. For instance, you can sing, you know, a Michael Jackson song, or you can do kirtan. Both are action. One will have a reaction. The other one is Dibya. It's transcendental. There's no reaction to it in this material world. You will get benefit from it, but the benefit will be on solely and wholly on a spiritual level. So that's like the hardest thing to do, because action, I'm going to act, but how do I know what's spiritual action as opposed to karmic action as opposed to dekarmic action? And that's why you see there's so many books in the Vedic library, if you use the word Vedas, you can be referring to the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, the Atharva Veda, the Yajur Veda, all of the Upanishads. There's 108 major Upanishads and hundreds of other Upanishads. The Aranyakas, the Puranas. There are many different Puranas. There are 18 primary Puranas. The Itihasas, which means the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. You can be referring to so many different books. Why? Because the Vedic progression, it's a progression of thought that leads you from the beginning of life, wherever you may enter onto your spiritual path or onto your path, it leads you from there all the way to the conclusion or moksha or liberation or actually being free from any entanglement, any bondage. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita in the third chapter, can't remember. He says there's two types of action. I can remember the English. I was trying to think of the Sanskrit. Two types of action. Action that you do on a material level, that's action that causes reaction, whether the reaction is good or bad, but it brings you back into the wheel of samsara. Jagnartat karmano nyatra lokoyam karma bandhana. Action or sacrifice, action that you perform, if you perform it on a material level, whether it's good action or bad action, there's reaction. As long as you have reactions to your action, you have to take birth again into the wheel of samsara. A birth again. Lokoyam karma bandhana. Jagnata karma no nyatra, no act, no reaction to it. So if you do action in relationship to the Supreme, then there's no reaction to that. You may have reactions from past that you have to experience. It's not that you stop suffering anymore or you stop getting the benefits of what you did positively or negatively. That'll still continue, but you won't keep incurring reactions. So at the end of your life, if your mind has been liberated by the fact that you're performing inaction, or akarmic, or action that has no reaction, then when you come to a certain point and all of your reactions have been spent, just like having money in the bank account, you can only spend so long. And then when you start, if you're spending and not depositing, then eventually your bank account will be empty. So if you learn the secret that Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita, particularly in chapters 7 through 12, he gives a great secret there, a great nugget. And the nugget is how you can act spiritually in everything that you do. Parenting. You could be a spiritual parent. You could be a spiritual wife or husband. You could be every relationship. You can have that relationship can produce connection to the Supreme. Everything that you eat. In the Bhakti Yoga tradition, you'll see later on, Krishna says, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yomi Bhakti Priyachati. He says that you will eat. So offer me fruit, water, leaf, flower, I will accept it, and I will transcendentalize whatever you're eating. So even the action of eating can become akarmic. It's not even being vegetarian, because some people say I'm vegetarian. It's the action, or it's the mindfulness of recognizing that everything that I have has been given to me. It is a blessing. So with that kind of mindfulness, in gratitude, with a heart full of gratitude, I offer. And that food, which looks like a pakora, or rice, or chapati, or a veggie burger, or whatever, that food takes on a quality of spirituality, and just by taking it. Many of you have been raised Catholic. You know the Catholic tradition? You get the Holy Communion. It's a wafer, bread, and wine, basically. Transformation. What was that transformation? The transformation was spirituality. This now becomes representative, Christ says, of my body. This is representative of my blood. It becomes spirituality. In the bhakti tradition, everything from that bag of Planters peanuts to the coconut milk that you buy, everything, if it's offered with love and devotion to the Supreme, it takes on, it's infused or illuminated with spiritual potency. Just like I have at home, I have a Himalayan salt lamp. Have you ever seen them? Basically, what are they? It's a block of salt, right? And they carve out and they put a light bulb in it. So the Himalayan salt, the salt itself is not illuminated. You need the light bulb, right? When you turn the light bulb on, then all of a sudden the Himalayan salt is illuminated. It's infused with light and then it transmits light. So anything that you do that is a karmic by nature, spiritual by nature, that becomes transformed. So the food, if you offer your food, it now becomes illuminated, it now becomes infused with transcendence, with the presence of the Supreme. And just by taking that food, it becomes cleansing. It cleanses the heart and opens up the heart and the mind to your true spiritual dimension, your true spiritual nature. So what Krishna is referring to here is, you can perform karmic action, pious activity, sukriti, and you'll get good things from that. You can perform bikarma, or impious activities, and you'll get negative things from that. So it's a no-brainer for people who study that. Oh, at least I want to do karmic activities. At least I want to get good reactions to what I'm doing. And therefore, there has to be what Krishna often refers to in Bhagavad Gita as yajna, or sacrifice. Sacrifice means you have to do something. But if you do it in the mindset of an offering, then and there are very specific rules and guidelines how to do it in the Vedas. The whole, the major Vedas, the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda, Atharva Veda, give all kinds of ways, performances, sacrifices that you can perform to achieve good health, to achieve a proper spouse, to get blessings for education, to get blessings for wealth, all that type of thing. But when you evolve to a certain point, you're not really interested in that. You're really interested in uncovering the spiritual dimension of your existence. And that's what bhakti actually is. And that's what Krishna is saying here. Karma, perform karma, get good reactions. Perform vikarma, get bad reactions. Or learn the science, bhakti, the science of action that has no reaction. And thus, all of your action will be the source of liberation, the source of uncovering. Because right now, to the degree that we do not realize the soul as separate and distinct from the body, as separate and distinct from the mind, as separate and distinct from the intelligence, to the degree that we do not feel our presence, adhyatma, the presence of the soul, the self, to that degree means that we're covered. We're covered by contact with the material energy, being illusioned, or put into illusion by the material energy, and under the influence of ignorance. And ignorance simply means not being able to see things as they are, not to be able to see things on the absolute or the absolute truth level. So this uncovering process, or the analogy which is sometimes used, is the blossoming of the lotus flower. When you see a lotus flower and it hasn't blossomed, it's just a tight bud. Tight like that. But as the sun rises, I used to live in Florida. I lived in Florida for 6 years, and we had a pond in our backyard, and we had water lilies. So every night the water lily would close up really tight, but every morning when the sun would shine, you would watch, just sit out there and watch the lily embrace the sun. So like that, that's the unfolding of our consciousness. It's the evolution of our consciousness. And when we make a conscious effort to act, because act we must, act in an akarmic way, then very quickly, it's like the sun rising very brightly. No clouds. Clouds are compared to illusion. Clouds of illusion. No clouds are there. And then what it does is it fully works on the lotus flower of the heart to unfold, to blossom, so that there's full realization of the soul. So the science of bhakti simply means piece it all together in a way that it's yoga, it's connection, it's linking up to the absolute truth, bhakti through devotion, through love. And then this awakening occurs. Any questions? Anyone have any question or comment? Yes?
I'm confused about something having to do with society and karma, and it could get very complicated unless I choose some simple examples. So I don't understand the way that if society provides something such as an increase or decrease in funding for a particular medical condition, we'll have entire generations of people that will improve in that area, whether or not it is their individual karma. So that what comes to mind is an infant mortality rate, because that can be a barometer of the degree of funding that the government gives to women's clinics, that kind of thing. And that happens in waves that go up and down according to the degree to which society values that. So how is that? How does the individual karma play into that if everybody is actually being affected by the social?
There's a thing called collective karma too. There's individual karma and collective karma. And collective karma is a kind of a hard thing to understand. But an easy way to understand it is everybody on an airplane that crashes. By their karma, somehow or another, they are to die at that moment. And they come together with 270 other people who also, their karma fructifies in that way, at that particular moment. So government is actually meant, according to the Vedas, government is led by a leader. And the leader is not just called a king or a leader. Actually, at the end of it is rishi. They're supposed to be spiritual by nature. So the government is supposed to enact different things like that, which is dharmic, which produces, which has influence and produces good reactions for society in general. But there's a collective thing. So someone, if a group of people, whether it's a minority group or a particular gender or a particular age group, they're benefiting, there's also a thing called collective karma. So somehow or another, through the intricacies of the law of karma, collectively there's benefit, collectively there's not benefit, like in the case of a plane crash or when you have a government genocide or something like that, where thousands of people are affected in almost the same way. So the law of karma includes a collective perspective as well as the individual perspective too. Now see, the proposal of Bhagavad Gita is that if government, if we have in charge of our governments, our leaders are Rajarshis, our leaders, but saintly leaders, which truly have, that's the qualification. They have to possess leadership qualities like heroism and generosity and all kinds of qualities which actually, denote one kind of person as a leader and another person as a kind of a follower. So there are qualities, natural attributes, which kind of indicate. And Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita, and also in this fourth chapter. He says, really, society is broken down into four divisions, four basic divisions. They're not castes, as was perverted in India. They are actually basic divisions that are determined by one's action and one's quality, one's qualification, not by birth. Birthright was something that was concocted later on. So one will show leadership qualities and have a natural propensity to do leadership-type activities. But the other thing which is missing, sorely missing nowadays, is the rishi part of it, which is the saintly part of it. A saintly leader looks at his or her citizens to protect for their benefit, not for their exploitation or their demise or whatever, but just to protect them. So everything that he enforces or she enforces in that leadership role will affect the prajna, or the citizenry, in a very positive way. And therefore, collectively, they're experiencing, you know, good things happen. Society becomes more of a controlled dynamic rather than an uncontrolled, wild, violent entity. You know, it becomes something more of a control under that kind of leadership. So in general, your question is referring to collective karma that is, you know, effectively promoted by leadership, especially if the program affects citizenry in a very positive way. Yes?
First of all, thank you for your attention, Father.
Thank you so much.
Inspirational.
Thank you.
I had a question about the spending of good karmic seeds. You're rich and you have like a bank account, right?
Right.
You keep spending them and there's eventually nothing left. When I did teacher training at Jirukti, they talked about that, how we were all here collectively, and as a result of that, we've used up a lot of good karmic seeds that we may have planted originally. And because we're here, you've not burned up and used up some of those karmic seeds. Can you talk a bit more about that, if the action you're doing is one of inaction, is one of coming closer to the supreme transcendent, would that still be using up those good karmic seeds?
The analogy is the one you mentioned. It burns the seeds. Just like if you have seeds and you put them in an oven and you roast them, they will no longer produce. They will no longer fructify. That heat. So the fire of inaction or spiritual activity actually takes out the karmic seeds, the reactions. The problem is if you still maintain, you're still doing the karmic action or karmic action, you're again replenishing. It's again, if you want to empty your bank account, but you keep making deposits, you'll never empty your bank account because you keep depositing in. So the principle of karma and vikarma specifically means you're continuing to make deposits. Therefore, you're continuing to suffer or enjoy reactions from those deposits. Which means at the time of death, if you have a storehouse of reactions, you've got to take birth to experience it again. The storehouse of reaction determines the birth that you're going to take. It determines the family that you're going to take. It determines the socioeconomic level that you'll be born into. It determines a lot of things which puts you, like I said, exactly where you're supposed to be. Where you're supposed to be is the result what you did. So if you continue to deposit into that account, then you have to continue to suffer or enjoy the reactions. Akarma dibyam, transcendental action, means there's no deposit going on. So essentially what you have left is, my teacher used the analogy of a fan. The fan, as long as the fan is plugged into the wall, the rotors spin. So as long as you're performing karmic or vikarmic activities, your rotors are spinning. If you pull the plug from the wall, no more electricity is going. The rotors don't automatically stop. They continue to go and go and go, and then finally they'll stop once the momentum has dwindled to nothing. So what that means is, if you immerse yourself in a bhakti immersion where you are always performing, all of your activities is an offering. Everything. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, yat karoshi, yat ashnasi, yat jahosi, didasya, yat tapasya kontiya, mat karusha mad arpanam. All that you do, all that you offer, all that you give away in charity, all austerities that you perform, everything, if you do it as an offering to me, then it's liberating. So really, the goal is, A, Sangha, find the person. In the Bhakti Yoga tradition, you can't start your path in earnest until you find your teacher, that person that can guide you on the path, Mahajana Yena Gata Sanpantaha. That means follow in the footsteps of the great soul. Because that foot, he's already traversed the path, or she's already traversed the path. So you follow in their footsteps because they've already traversed the path. So that's where you have to come to grips with your life, how much or how little you want to dedicate yourself to your spirituality. And it's solely and wholly an individual commitment. But it is not restrictive. It means, well, if you say, I'm a mother of three children, how can I solely and wholly dedicate my life? I've got three kids to take care of. No, you can. You can keep sangha. You can do mantra. You can make your home a holy place. In the center of my home is an altar. And everything that I have is offered to my deities. They are the proprietors of my home. So my home is a sacred place. And it's helping my heart to become a sacred place. So you can do mantra, you can do sangha, you can do tirtha, or holy place. You can do swadhyaya. You're doing it right now. Every week, Joshua has this beautiful class. But swadhyaya is not limited to Tuesday nights. If you can't do it by yourself, there's opportunities all over the city. And almost every evening, you could have swadhyaya. You can do study. Or just get into the habit of picking up Gita and reading one verse a day. Every day, one verse a day. It takes you 5 minutes. My wife and I sometimes, often we chant a chapter a day in Sanskrit and English. So that's our swadhyaya. You know, we're really connecting with the Supreme through our study. And you could do all of these things. It's not. And then what happens is those stash or storehouse of karmic reactions, they're getting burnt up in the fire of akarma. So they're being removed. You're not performing any more reactive kind of action. You're performing inaction. And at the time of death, what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Whatever one thinks of at the time of death, that's where you will go. Whatever state of mind, that will guide you to your destination. And what does Krishna say? Manmana bhavamad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskaru. Always think of me. If you can, Arjuna, he tells Arjuna, if you can, even as a warrior, always think of me. You will come to me. You will be with me. So that, but what prevents us from coming or thinking is the reactions, what we're experiencing. All these things. Does that help?
Yeah. One more question.
Yes.
No, we have one more question.
Oh, we have one more question?
Yeah, one more.
Okay. Yes.
I also want to just thank you for taking this past trip to the path of knowledge. It's really the way you teach your life is great. And do you have a website? Thank you. Do you have a web? Do you have an email or a list that you can put us on if you wish to?
Absolutely, absolutely. I've just been installed as the executive director of the Bhakti Center. So in a few weeks, I'll be moving into Manhattan, and I'll be teaching regularly at the Bhakti Center on First Avenue, between First and Second Street. Yeah, so I'll be there. I'll be teaching there. And my strength is the philosophy, and we also have yoga there too, but
yeah.
I do the Bhakti philosophy and practice.
What day would that be? Because I go Gita study on Saturday nights.
Oh, you go there at the 26th Second Avenue?
Yes. Well,
yeah.
What day will you be
teaching? Tuesday nights, every Tuesday night and every Sunday. Not always me, but I'll be there a lot. And I can put you on the email list. And like next Tuesday, I spoke this Tuesday night. Next Tuesday night is Swami Damodar, who's also, he's a very famous bhakti practitioner. He's speaking Tuesday night.
Tuesday and Sunday, basically.
Yeah, Tuesday and Sunday is the speaking, and as we progress more and more, where the building's under some renovation right now, we're going to also be doing drama and different things like that. It's a cultural and educational institute. We're going to be making all these different presentations.
It's very brief.
Sure.
I just want to know if there was a time in your life when you thought that you were on the Gyan path.
I entered really, well, I didn't know I was on the Gyan path. But I was, prior to entering into bhakti, because all my studies led me to Gita. I was studying Buddhism and Taoism and a lot of different things. And I was on the Gyan path, because why does Krishna open up with the Gyan in second chapter? The second chapter, half the second chapter is all Gyan. Krishna's telling you, you know, Dehino smin yata dehe kamodam jovanam jada. Your progression. You go from boyhood or girlhood to youth, from youth to middle age to old age, and then again back into the cycle. That's all Gyan. A true Gyani, that's what they're studying. The true Gyani, he or she knows the distinction between matter and spirit. And ultimate goal is to live in the self, in pure consciousness, rather than mind or intellect or egoism. Live in pure consciousness. So yes, I didn't know it, but I was on the Gyan path. And then Gyan path led me to Gita, and then Gita led me to Bhakti. And then 40 years later, I'm still trying. Yes, sir.
Don't you find yoga is the best protection of your whole life, mind, body, spirit, and temperance?
The practice of yoga?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like it's a protection for you.
Yep.
It just like never ends and it goes higher and higher.
Yes.
Before that, the old world of things that go on is worldly. But actually, yoga transcends beyond the body, it's beyond through the whole world. So you find it's the greatest thing ever.
I can only speak for myself. It's the greatest thing that happened to me. I mean, you know, nothing has really changed in my life. It's just now I'm running a parallel course. I'm doing my material responsibilities. I own an art gallery, so I have a business, and from that business I support my family. But simultaneously I have my sadhana, where I'm chanting, I do japa every day, I do kirtan every day, I do swadhyaya every day, I seek out sangha every day. So in this way, I'm traveling, you know, the parallel course. Do my material responsibilities. I go see my mother every week. I help my family. I help my son. I do all my responsibilities on that level out of love and affection for them. But simultaneously, I do my sadhana, my spiritual practice. So, yes, for me. Thank you so much. I appreciate your kind attention.
We close with three alms.
Okay. Would you like to lead it?
No, it's your
Okay.
Do accept donations for our speaker tonight.